I hope that we see some kind of confrontation of this genocidal serial killer masquerading as a nation state that is modern Israel. But I doubt it, because history shows that they are just sitting on their hands and saying, oh, here's a strongly worded statement.
And you've mentioned the history of the past couple of years in terms of Israel attempting to kill Palestinian leaders. But this is a decades long policy of constantly trying to decapitate the leadership of a Palestinian resistance. And you would think by this time the Israelis would recognize that this policy doesn't work because it only helps to foment more resistance among the people.
I mean, it is absolutely clear from 76 years of history and looking at what I think can objectively be called the steadfastness of the Palestinian people that you can kill the leaders. You can't kill the ideas. You can't kill the struggle. So if there isn't a Hamas, if somehow Hamas ceases to exist as a political entity and a resistance movement, other Palestinians are going to pick up the mantle and run with it. And one of the reasons why Hamas negotiators, and by the way, it's not just Hamas, many Palestinian factions are now involved with these negotiations, including some that are critical of Hamas or some that don't even have armed wings. They all are unified in saying we will not give up our right to bear arms. They cite international conventions and basic ethics and morality that an occupied people have a right to resist. But if you actually embrace the idea that Israel functions as an industrial scale serial killer hunting Palestinians, then you understand that they want to kill any Palestinian that is capable of standing up and describing the Palestinian liberation cause to the world. In 1972, they used a car bomb to kill Ghassan Kanafani, one of the most famous Palestinian literary figures and poets, who was a leader and spokesperson of a political liberation movement at the time. They killed the quadriplegic spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, in a drone strike in 2004. They killed Al-Rantisi, another one of the Hamas founders, in a bombing in Gaza. They killed Ismail Haniyeh last summer in Iran. They try to systematically kill Palestinians. And they also, there's a subsection of this one, which is that the very Palestinians who are trying to negotiate some form of a truce with Israel, Israel then targets them and kills them. The second in command of the Qassam Brigades, Hamas's armed wing, Ahmed Jabari, was killed in 2012 as he was in the middle of trying to broker some form of a ceasefire or long-term truce with Israel. And so what we're seeing now in the bombing of the Hamas office in Qatar, where they killed, you know, people are saying, oh, they're low-ranking members. Secretaries were killed. Young people who were drivers or bag carriers for certain Hamas figures. That's who was killed in this strike that happened in a country that houses CENTCOM, that Donald Trump recently said falls under the security umbrella of the United States. At the end of the day, Americans should be asking themselves, is all of this worth the cost that America is bankrolling this, arming this, supporting this, encouraging this? Serious questions about U.S. involvement in this strike itself, because that entire region is going to be set on fire very quickly. And I guarantee you there's a lot of nervousness in the capitals of those Gulf countries and in Arab countries in general, because the population of those countries see in plain sight that their leaders are doing nothing and at times even collaborating with the U.S. and Israel. So this is an incendiary moment that is rooted in a 76-year history of a U.S.-enforced war of annihilation being waged by Israel against the Palestinian people.
Jeremy, I wanted to get your reaction to Matt Dess of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, who told The Guardian, this is an attack on the capital of a major non-NATO U.S. ally in the midst of U.S.-supported negotiations against officials who originally hosted there at the United States' request. It's an attack on diplomacy itself. Of course, Qatar says they're going to continue to be a mediator. The significance of, as you write, the 100-word ceasefire that Trump put forward, and the idea, and this happened before also, that as they gather to consider what the U.S. sent, Israel tries to blow them up, what this means for the future of diplomacy as world leaders from the Gulf to Europe condemn what has just taken place. And also, by the way, how much of this do you think is motivated by Netanyahu, the prime minister, being on trial for corruption? And as these things happen, it takes him out of the trial.
Well, you know, to take on the first part of it, let's remember that the recent track record that is out in the open of Donald Trump, the United States claimed to be in good faith negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program and trying to reset the U.S.-Iranian relationship. And Trump then openly declared that this was effectively a covert operation, a cover operation to catch the Iranians off guard. And the United States and the Israelis then did sustained bombing for 12 days against Iran. Trump came out and basically said, we lied about being engaged in negotiations. So that fact alone out in the open means that we have to question what potential role the U.S. played in this strike. When you take that and combine it with the threats that Trump was increasingly aiming at Hamas's leaders, when you take that in conjunction with the fact that the chief of staff of the Israeli army said just over a week ago that they're going to start assassinating political leaders, and that Israeli media reported that Donald Trump himself had made clear to Hamas's political leadership that assassination of them was on the table by Israel if they didn't capitulate to his ultimatum. So, you know, is the idea of diplomacy, there is no diplomacy in these cases with Donald Trump. He uses something that should be a very sacred process because it requires trust on both sides, and he's used it in a covert operation to bomb Iran. And now he has allowed, and I say allowed because the United States could have easily shot down those munitions from Israel from the capacity that it has placed in Qatar, to allow this kind of attack to happen in the borders of a country that the U.S. itself asked to host Hamas negotiators so that they could have this process, means that the U.S. Can't be trusted at all. Now, most people wouldn't trust the U.S. in general, who know history, but even on the issue of we're engaging in negotiations, it's now used as a covert operation. Now, as to the second part of it with Netanyahu's domestic political situation, yes, Netanyahu is facing trouble. But if you actually look at the political reality, more than 80% of Israelis right now in recent public polls, Jewish Israelis, that is, support the program in Gaza. And, you know, for all of the talk of Netanyahu's coalition being in trouble if Ben-Gvir goes or if Smotrich goes, I think that there's quite a bit of exaggeration and distraction at play, thinking that Netanyahu is primarily motivated by getting rid of these political scandals. He's at the zenith of his bloody career. He believes that he has to get done as much as he can while Donald Trump is in power. And that's why I think we're seeing also increasing moves toward trying to fully annex the West Bank. Smotrich, who for all practical purposes is in charge of the West Bank right now, implying that they may seek to deport a 500,000 or more Palestinians, claiming that they're actually really Jordanians and that they need to go back to Jordan. They've severed the West Bank in half. They're in the midst of the largest forced displacement campaign since 1967. Netanyahu's trying to run the deck right now, and I think he's not as concerned about his domestic political situation as he is as impacting or implementing his genocidal agenda while he has the most favorable possible administration in power in the U.S.
Jeremy, before you go, I wanted to ask about this latest drop site news reporting that the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has ordered authorities to examine an appeal from the National Council for Human Rights urging the release of Alaa Abdel Fattah and six other people on humanitarian grounds. Dropsite said on X, a dual British-Egyptian, Abdel Fattah, has been imprisoned over much of the past decade and is currently serving 5 years for, quote, spreading false news. His sister, Sana Swef, called the move really promising, but pressed for urgency. He was a leader of the 2011 uprising, a symbol of Egypt's democratic collapse. His detention alongside his mother's hunger strike and protest in Britain has fueled mounting domestic and international pressure for his freedom. Can you talk more about the significance of this, the possibility of Alaa being freed?
Alaa Abdel Fattah is one of the most noble humans among us, and he has been rotting in a prison cell and refusing to die. He has been resisting from that prison cell, enduring unspeakable treatment at the hands of the Egyptian authorities. And let's remember that that Egyptian revolution that Ala Abdel Fattah was one of the young leaders of resulted in a democratic election. And the democratically elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was put in prison and then died in a prison cell in a coup that was enacted by General Sisi. And so his case is a symbol of so much of what we've seen happen in that region, that you had this one window in time when the people of Egypt rose up. And it wasn't that all of the people that were rising up were members of the Muslim Brotherhood or supported the agenda of Mohamed Morsi. It was that they were saying, we are done with this U.S.-backed dictatorship governing our lives and imposing its authoritarianism on us. And so the attempt to crush the spirit of Ala Abdel Fattah has failed. And it's because of the steadfastness of his mother and his family that we can even imagine a day where he walks out of that prison cell. I think all people who believe in the struggle for liberation, not just in Egypt, but that whole region, hold Ala Abdel Fattah close to their hearts and hope for the moment that they see him walk out of that prison cell.
Jeremy Scahill, thanks so much for being with us, co-founder of DropSite News. His latest piece we'll link to. It's an exclusive, the 100-word ceasefire proposal Trump sent Hamas. Thanks so much for being with us from Croatia. When we come back, here comes the sun, a last chance for the climate and a fresh chance for civilization. Climate activist and author Bill McKibben. Stay with us.
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Hugo Chavez highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies, and which lady is crying over luxury's disappointment? So he goes over and he's trying to sympathize with her, but he thinks that he should warn her that the climate emergency is just around the corner, yeah. In the former Soviet Union, the scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded...
Billy Bragg singing Waiting for the Great Leap Forward in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the climate crisis. A new report by the clean energy tech research group Ember finds China's, quote, creating the conditions for a decline in fossil fuel use, unquote, as it leads the production of solar panels and wind turbines. Meanwhile, another new report confirms the Trump administration's openly hostile to renewable energy and has overseen, quote, the most abrupt shift in energy and climate policy in recent memory, unquote, which has led to a jump in greenhouse gas emissions in the first 7 months of the Trump presidency. Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill not only ended subsidies for renewable power sources, but applies a new tax on solar and wind projects. On Friday, the Department of Energy wrote on social media, quote, wind and solar energy infrastructure is essentially worthless when it's dark outside and the wind is not blowing, they said. Trump criticized renewable energy efforts during a recent cabinet meeting.
We don't allow windmills. We're not allowing any windmills to go up. I mean, unless there's a legal situation where somebody committed to it a long time ago, we don't allow windmills. And we don't want the solar panels that I was speaking with the secretary about, because they take up, you know, thousands of acres of our farmland. You see these big, ugly patches of black plastic that comes from China.
Despite all this, the Los Angeles Times reports today renewable energy reached nearly 25% of U.S. power generation in June, up from 18% last year. We spend the rest of the hour with Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, founder of the group Third Act. His new book is titled Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. You actually, Bill McKibben, despite Trump going back on renewable energy, people fear going back decades, hold out great hope. You see this as an opportunity we've never had before.
Amy, Juan, you guys have been at this for a long time. This is as dark a moment as there's ever been in our democracy, and our planet is overheating fast. In the midst of that, there is this one big good thing simultaneously happening. And it's so big and so good that it might help with both the climate and the authoritarianism crisis. And that's this rise in the last 36 months, a pretty untold story of just extraordinary amounts of clean energy surging into the world's energy system. It is centered in China, and the numbers are staggering. The May is the last month we have data for. In May, the Chinese were putting up 3 gigawatts of solar panels a day, a gigawatt being the rough equivalent of a coal-fired power plant. They were putting up one of those made out of solar panels every 8 hours. California, which has done more than any place in this country, reached some kind of tipping point in the last 18 months. Most days now, California supplies more than 100% of its electricity from renewable energy for long stretches. At night, the biggest source of supply on its grid is batteries that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon. Bottom line, California, fourth largest economy in the world, is using 40% less natural gas to produce electricity than they were 2 years ago. That's the kind of number, that may be the most optimistic thing that I've, number that I've heard in the 40 years I've been working on the climate crisis. It's the kind of number that begins to shave tenths of a degree off how hot the world eventually gets. And remember, every tenth of a degree means 100 million people moving from a safe climate zone to a dangerous one. So it's not that we're going to stop global warming. It's too late for that. It's that we have really a chance to reboot the way the world and its economy and its geopolitics works right now.
And Bill, I wanted to ask you about this staggering investment that China has been putting into renewable energies. It's it accounts now for almost a third of all the clean energy investment in the world. It's producing 80% of all the solar panels, 60% of the wind turbines. And so all of this investment has actually driven the price of green energy down, so that now it's in some according to the Ember report, 90% of wind and solar projects commissioned worldwide produce power more cheaply than fossil fuel alternatives. So doesn't this mean that the global south now will gobble up, the poorer nations of the world will gobble up clean energy alternatives to fossil fuel?
Absolutely, Juan. It's really important to understand that as of about 4 years ago, we live on a planet where the cheapest way to produce energy is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. And China has been leading that effort. We know about petrostates. China's the world's first electrostate. And now, as you say, that's leaking out from across its borders. Pakistan, right next door, last year, Pakistanis, just basically using TikTok videos as their guide, installed enough solar panels to equal half the country's national electric grid. Pakistani farmers, who are early adopters of this because diesel to run their tube wells for irrigation is their biggest cost input, they bought millions of these solar panels. They lack the money to build the metal stanchions to point them at the sun. So instead, they're just laying them on the ground. Nonetheless, Pakistan was using 35% less diesel last year than the year before. Now this is leaking into Africa, not just the solar panels, but the things that make use of the clean energy that they provide. We're used to thinking of Detroit as the center of the world's auto industry. That is not true. It's now two or three cities in China whose names I find difficult to pronounce. They're producing the best and cheapest cars on the planet, and they are flooding the markets of the developing world. Forget about Ford. It's BYD that's going to be the car company of the future.
And but yet here we are in the United States going in the complete opposite direction from what China and the rest of the world are striving for. How do we deal with that situation here in this country?
So it's what's so fascinating. And it's pretty easy, I think, to explain the success of renewable energy, which is good news for almost everyone on the planet, except the people who own oil wells and coal mines. And for them, it's an existential threat. So what did they do? You'll recall candidate Trump last year telling the oil industry that for $1 billion, it was kind of an Austin Powers moment, for $1 billion, they could have anything they wanted. They ended up raising about $500 million between donations, advertising, lobbying in the last election cycle. And clearly that was enough because the Trump administration has done everything that big oil could have hoped and more, really. I mean, I don't think anyone anticipated that they would actually shut down work on 80% complete wind farms off the coast of New England like they did last week. That's just insane. I mean, if they keep with it, 1,000 years from now, archaeologists will be trying to explain how this aqueous Stonehenge emerged off the coast of Rhode Island. We're if we keep at this, our role in the world a decade from now will be as the kind of colonial Williamsburg of internal combustion, a place where the rest of the planet, if they can get tourist visas, come to gawk at how people did things in the olden days. And that's especially aggravating, or should be, for Americans, because this technology was invented here. I mean, the solar cell was invented 20 miles away in Edison, New Jersey. The first industrial wind turbine was 30 miles south of my house in Vermont in the 1940s. And yet we're just handing it all to China in order to appease the oil industry.
You talk about California. You're headed, what, to D.C. to speak of politics and prose, then the Petro Metro. That's Houston. You're headed to Texas.
Yeah.
Texas might surprise people when it comes to solar and wind energy.
Texas is now putting up clean energy faster than California, faster than any place in this country. Big oil doesn't like that, and they tried in the state legislative session this year to pass a number of laws, the most prominent of which people called DEI for natural gas. It was going to force anybody who wanted to put up 5 megawatts of solar to also put up 5 megawatts of natural gas. People emerged from the hinterlands across rural Texas to say, don't do this. This is how we pay property taxes in our county. This is what keeps the schools open. And so the legislature backed off, returned to their project of redistricting Texas to help Mr. Trump instead. It's not clear that even in this country they can beat down the economics of renewable energy, though obviously they're going to do much damage, which is precisely why we're rallying across the country on September 21st for this thing we're calling Sunday.
You're wearing a T-shirt that says Sunday.
Indeed I am, because there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of events planned for that day. We obviously can't change policy in Washington in the short term, but we can change policy in states and localities across the country to make it much, much easier to do solar power. Amy, it costs 3 times as much to put up solar panels in the U.S. as it does on your house in Australia or the EU. Tiny bit of that's from tariffs on solar panels. Mostly it's because we have 15,000 municipalities, each with their own building code and team of inspectors. It can take months to get done what takes days every place else. This can be changed with ease by local officials. California, Maryland, and New Jersey have already adopted this thing called the Solar App that allows a contractor to get instant permitting just by putting a few details into a computer program. We need that across the country, especially in light of federal intransigence.
Sunday is September 21st, the fall equinox.
The fall equinox, exactly right.
Bill, I wanted to ask you, last month, the Environmental Protection Agency formally proposed revoking the Obama-era scientific determination that greenhouse gases are a danger to public health and welfare because they cause global warming. Your response to that and what people can do?
I mean, it's nonsense, of course. The EPA and the Trump administration can't repeal the laws of physics, which are the problem here. That's what's driving climate change. But I think there's something deeper going on as we move into this possibility of a world that runs on clean energy. And I was really thinking about it as we were listening to Jeremy report from Middle East. I mean, think about, you guys have run the War and Peace Report for a long time. Think about what this show and this world would have been like for the last few decades if oil was of trivial value on this planet. How many wars and coups and assassination attempts would have been averted? Humans are, you know, altogether too good at starting wars, but figuring out how to start one over sunshine will be a trick. I think that this is not just a possibility for dealing with climate change. I think the fact that we have access now to energy that's available to everyone everywhere, instead of being something concentrated in a few spots, controlled by a few autocrats and plutocrats, that's a huge, huge potential gift.
It's a real challenge to capitalism because, well, I mean, this is decentralized as you can get, unless the big oil companies, when they see their days are numbered, just switch over to try to control the access to the sun.
Even if they switch over, which I don't think they will, I'm afraid, all they can do, and it's very important and you can make a lot of money doing it, is build the solar panels. But once you've built the solar panels, the sun delivers the energy for free every morning when it rises above the horizon. There's no way to hoard it or hold it in reserve. The same charismatic object in our galaxy that brings us light and warmth and via photosynthesis our food is now willing to provide us with all the power we could ever want. That's the kind of moment that changes civilization as thoroughly as learning to harness the combustion of fossil fuel changed civilization. That's what we call the Industrial Revolution.
You're here in New York. Zoran Mamdani has just shocked the Democratic establishment, still the Democratic leader in Congress from New York. Hakeem Jeffries, astonishingly, has not endorsed the Democratic primary candidate. But how do you see Zoran Mamdani's race for mayor of New York as a model for the rest of the country?
Well, I mean, the fact that he's creative and full of good humor is a shocking thing in our political life. But it's a real reminder of how much there is that we could do. Across Europe, in cities full of apartment dwellers like New York, millions of people have put up what we call balcony solar over the last 3 years. They just go to the Best Buy, come home with a solar panel designed to hang over the railing of their apartment balcony, plug it into the wall with a standard plug, and producing 20% of the power they use. That's illegal everywhere in the country, except in the state of Utah, where the state legislature, that progressive bastion, enabled it by a unanimous vote earlier this year. I'm betting that within weeks of Mr. Mamdani becoming Mayor Mamdani, we're going to see balcony solar installations sprouting across the five boroughs, and what a nice sign that'll be.
And you gave this, you started Sunday with another renegade mayor, and that is Michelle Wu of Boston, who Trump is trying to take on.
Michelle Wu,
Zoran
Mamdani, people like this offer a real potential future, and they have an enormous ally in this new technology that really gives us a fresh kind of hope.
Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, founder of the organization Third Act. His new book is just out, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. He is on book tour. Tonight he'll be in D.C. at Politics and Prose, tomorrow in Houston. And he's organizing a national mobilization for September 21st, the fall equinox, called Sunday 2025, celebrating solar and wind power. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience.
And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.